Good morning, everyone. This is Jay Jordan, and welcome to our quarterly conference call, where we'll be giving an update and outlook on the financial markets and the implications for your portfolio. As an optional slide deck is available on our website to support today's call, if you go to www.heritagewealth.net and you scroll down to the In the News section, you can click on the October 12th conference call slides. I'd also like to point out that there is a link to our weekly What We're Discussing piece, which is posted on the Friday afternoons immediately below the slides on our website. The format for today's call will be as follows. Our Director of Research, Jack Kasperzak, will lead off the call, followed by Senior Investment Analyst, Kerry Baronian, discussing financial markets and implications for your portfolios. Chase Hill, our Director of Client Service, will then follow with some comments on potential tax legislation. We will open up the call for Q&A after our prepared remarks. Instructions regarding Q&A will be given at that time to register for a question. Today's call is being recorded. Everyone's lines will be placed on mute until the Q&A section of the call begins. With that, I'll turn the call over to Jack Kasperzak.
Thank you, Jay. Good morning, everyone. Stocks continued their winning ways in the third quarter. The Dow Jones Industrial Average posted its eighth straight positive quarter, the index's best winning streak in 20 years. The S&P 500, which rose 4.5% in the third quarter, has risen just over 14% so far this year and is on track to have its best year since 2013. I will discuss the earnings outlook for stocks a bit later on the call, but even after such a strong performance through the first 9 months of the year, the price earnings multiple on the S&P 500 stands at about 18 times, which is above the long-term average of about 16 times, but we would argue reasonable given prevailing low interest rates and a strong profit outlook. Strong performance across virtually all asset classes seems a bit surreal given deepening political rifts domestically, heightened political tensions with North Korea, not to mention the omnipresent problems with Russia and Iran, and most recently mass murder in Las Vegas. Nothing seems to derail the rally, and the fact that geopolitical rifts in particular do not impact the markets is vexing to investors broadly. While U.S. equities are performing well, even better performance is coming from overseas markets. International developed markets and emerging markets continued to do well in the third quarter, rising 6.2% and nearly 8% respectively. Emerging markets are up 30% so far this year, continuing their bounce after recent years of lagging performance. Fears of rising interest rates at the beginning of the year have proven unfounded thus far, and fixed income markets are still showing positive returns. Finally, while still down for the year, commodities bounced nicely in the third quarter with oil prices pushing back above $50 a barrel and other industrial metals rising on the back of improved global economic growth. Turning to sectors, technology and healthcare remain the leaders within the S&P 500. Technology is up 27.4% year to date, and healthcare is up 20.3%. After a terrible first half of the year where it was down 12.6%, the worst performing sector, energy, gained some momentum during the third quarter and is now down just 6.6% through the first 9 months of the year. As mentioned, oil prices rebounded in the third quarter and are now about flat with they were this time last year. 10 of the 11 S&P 500 sectors were up in the third quarter, consumer staples being the lone decliner, and 9 of the 11 are positive on a year-to-date basis. The drivers behind such broad positive performance across asset classes, notably equities, this year may not be all that complicated. Immediately following the election, markets rallied on the promise of fiscal stimulus, tax reform, infrastructure spending, and regulatory relief were supposed to be enacted quickly and spark economic growth. Instead, what has happened is a good old-fashioned earnings-driven recovery. When viewed in this light, the stock market rally seems reasonable, if not appropriate. Earnings will be up about 10% in 2017 for the S&P 500, and as noted, the index is up a bit more than that so far this year, about 14%. Earnings improvement is happening not just at home, but also abroad. Japan, Europe, and the emerging markets are all riding a strong earnings wave right now. In fact, the globe is enjoying a synchronized earnings recovery for the first time in years. The S&P 500 outperformed most other asset classes in recent years. An extended period of outperformance like this versus all other asset classes is unusual historically. 2017 has been a good year for investors, but also a reminder of the importance of maintaining exposure to various asset classes so as not to miss periods when outperformance in a specific area occurs. Turning a bit more to next year and beyond, the outlook for continued earnings improvement appears bright. Global leading economic indicators, which bottomed out in the latter part of 2015, have remained positive and now stand at multi-year highs. If anything, growth around the world is accelerating. Europe is firing on all cylinders, and Japan's economy is on its best trajectory in a decade. Just look at some of the recent data points on the U.S. economy that bode well for 2018. The services economy is at a 12-year high. Manufacturing activity is at a 13-year high. Durable goods orders last month were positive, up 2%. The latest read on auto sales came in stronger than expected, the best in 12 months, and the unemployment rate is close to 4% and wages are growing. Looking at the all-important manufacturing sector more closely shows a striking picture. The Global Purchasing Managers Index, known as PMI, which is an indicator of health of the manufacturing sector, is showing expansion for every major country in the survey. Many, like the U.S., are at all-time highs. I mentioned Japan. I mentioned Europe. But there are also countries that are showing growth that you might not expect. Greece, Spain, Italy, all showing expansion in their manufacturing sector, for example. All these factors conflate to a rosy outlook for earnings. After three flat years from 2014 to 2016, earnings for the S&P 500 are expected to rise 10.5% this year. Consensus estimates are calling for an 11% rise in 2018 to $146.30 a share for the S&P 500. If one takes the current PE multiple on the S&P, as mentioned, about 18 times, you would get a target for the S&P 500 about 3 to 4% higher than where it is currently trading. Selecting the right multiple for a target is always tricky, but we have been and remain comfortable assuming above average multiple given prevailing low interest rates and the aforementioned rosy earnings outlook. The backdrop should remain positive for equities into next year. Improving economic activity and earnings have come without the help of fiscal stimulus. Interestingly, markets have not been anticipating action by Congress as companies that would presumably benefit from the Trump agenda, high taxpayers, infrastructure-focused, and small caps have underperformed the S&P 500 for most of the year. But when compared to expectations at the beginning of the year, the government's thus far broken promise of fiscal stimulus and reflation has yielded some surprising effects. The first of these is that long-term interest rates have remained low. After spiking to around 2.5% just after the election, the yield on the 10-year seems stuck in the 2.3% range. Low interest rates will continue to pose challenges for investors who need yield in their portfolios. Therefore, demand is likely to remain high for so-called bond surrogates, master limited partnerships, real estate investment trusts, preferreds, and bank loans as examples. Second surprise is that inflation has failed to percolate. A step up in economic growth, falling unemployment, and rising wages were thought to be the kindling to spark inflation. This, too, is yet to occur as inflation has remained below the Fed's target of 2%. Low inflation has significant implications for many things, but importantly to the outlook for equities. Should inflation remain contained, it would not be unreasonable, in our view, to expect stocks to continue to carry above average valuations. A third surprise has been the weak U.S. dollar. After surging immediately following the election, the dollar has weakened throughout the year, down about 9% against a basket of currencies globally. Interest rates in the U.S. are low in absolute terms, but relative to many other countries, they're high. This favorable differential was thought to favor a strong dollar. However, more favorable growth rates in economies outside the U.S. are attracting capital and leading to dollar weakness. Almost half of the revenue generated by the S&P 500 comes from outside the U.S. If the dollar remains weak over the next couple of quarters, foreign sales by U.S. companies will be translated into larger amounts of U.S. dollars, thus providing a potential boost to revenue. With that, I'm going to turn the call over to Carrie Baronian, who's going to discuss an important portfolio management strategy.
Thanks, Jack. Even when the bulls are stampeding, it's not unusual for stocks to decline meaningfully at some point during a calendar year. Drawdowns are defined as the market's loss from peak to trough before a new peak is attained. Since 1980, on average, the max drawdown for the S&P 500 during a calendar year is 14%. In other words, on average, the S&P loses as much as 14% at some point during a calendar year. This, of course, includes the crash of 1987, the bursting of the dot-com bubble in 2000, and most recently, the 08 financial crisis. Even if we remove these years of outsized declines from our sample, the S&P still loses, on average, as much as 10% at some point during a year. And on the whole, these were not particularly bad years of performance. In 26 of those 34 years, the S&P still posted a positive return for the year. Consequently, we really can't expect to see a meaningful decline in stocks at some point during any given year. Thus far in 2017, the largest drawdown is just shy of 3%, which no doubt is significantly below average. As we said, we are positive on equities. But if we close out 2017 with such a small decline as the worst drawdown of the year, we will add it to our list of surprises. As stocks have moved higher, we have made it a focus to consider the effects this has on client portfolios and take action when needed. Asset classes produce different returns over time that can change a portfolio's asset allocation. Stocks have greater return potential than fixed income, but are more volatile. The long run-up in stocks can skew the intended risk-return characteristics of a portfolio. For example, if held without rebalancing, a 60% equity, 40% fixed income portfolio will eventually drift to a 65-35 allocation, and then 70-30, and so on and so forth. While investors will enjoy the incremental wealth accumulated as a result of having a larger allocation to stocks, they may find their portfolios more aggressively positioned than they intended. Due to their specific circumstances, which often change over time, it may not be appropriate for them to accept this elevated level of risk. Consequently, rebalancing when portfolios drift significantly from target is important. Our research suggests that most investors do not rebalance, likely because they find it counterintuitive to sell winners and buy laggards. At Heritage, our goal is to construct and manage portfolios for our clients designed to meet their specific wealth objectives. Portfolio monitoring and rebalancing are formal components of our investment process. In fact, where appropriate, we recently rebalanced a number of client portfolios. It's an important tool we use as we work to deliver sound investment solutions to our clients. With that, I'll turn the call back over to Jack.
Thanks, Carrie. We're now going to turn the call over to Chase Hill, who's going to discuss the recent proposal for tax reform.
Thank you, Jack. A few times through the remarks today, we've made reference to the market's reaction to the promise of tax reform, and we thought we'd spend a few minutes providing you with an update on the latest proposal circulating on this reform. On September 27th, the White House, alongside members of the House Ways and Means Committee and Senate Finance Committee, released a 9-page unified framework for fixing our broken tax code. This plan was produced by the Big Six, which is the nickname given to Republican leaders responsible for crafting the framework. The 9 pages looks to expand upon the 1-page outline for tax reform, which was released by the White House earlier this year on April 26. We'll provide a few highlights from the framework, and we'll start with provisions impacting individuals before moving on to those impacting businesses. One of the biggest changes is a reduction in the number of tax brackets from the current system of 7, ranging from 10% to 39.6%, down to 3 brackets of 12%, 25%, and 35%. The plan does not currently specify the income ranges for each of these proposed brackets, and there has already been some indication that an additional higher income tax bracket could be added as a bargaining chip during negotiations. The framework also does not address the preferential tax bracket for long-term capital gain income and qualified dividend income, which currently tops out at 20%. In addition to simplifying the number of brackets, the plan touts a larger 0% tax bracket, which is achieved by doubling the standard deduction to $24,000 for a married couple and $12,000 for single taxpayers. One offset to this would be the elimination of the personal exemption deduction. The framework also proposes a repeal of the personal exemptions for dependents and instead increases the child tax credit, including a $1,000 refundable tax credit. It is suggested that the phase-out levels for these credits will be increased to make the credit more accessible for middle-income families. The plan proposes an elimination of the alternative minimum tax system as a means of simplifying the tax code. Many of our clients are familiar with this AMT system and have heard us talking about it for years. One of the underlying fundamentals of AMT is that it neutralizes the benefit of certain preferential tax items, including certain itemized deductions. As it turns out, limiting certain itemized deductions may still be part of the plan. There are only two sentences in the framework discussing itemized deductions. However, there is specific mention of preserving deductions for home mortgage interest and charitable contributions. We would assume that the deductions for state and local taxes are meant to be eliminated, and these are some of the first deductions that are usually added back during the AMT system. And we've already heard of a few people pushing back on the exclusion of state and local taxes, so we wouldn't be surprised to see that be one of the first things added back. The framework does affirm that they intend to maintain benefits available for retirement plan savings, such as 401ks, although it does reference the desire to simplify those benefits to improve their efficiency. This will be one area that we'll be watching very closely in the coming months. Finally, there is a single sentence in the framework that proposes the repeal of the estate or death tax and generation skipping taxes. Notably, there is no mention of the gift tax, and many would interpret this to mean that the gift tax will remain in effect. This would provide a backstop to prevent gifting in an effort to game the income tax system. On the business side, the proposal suggests a 25% maximum tax rate on the income of pass-through entities, such as sole proprietorships, partnerships, LLCs, and S-corporations. When this was first suggested earlier this year, many people got excited about the prospect of structuring entities to drive lower overall personal tax rates. However, the framework specifically calls on the committees to adopt measures to prevent the recharacterization of personal income into business income as a means of avoiding the top personal tax rate. The framework also proposes a reduction in the corporate tax rate to 20%, which is below the 22.5% average of industrialized economies. You may recall that the original one-page outline released in April had suggested a 15% corporate tax rate. In addition to lowering this tax rate, an elimination of the corporate AMT system is also proposed. The framework allows businesses to immediately write off the cost of new investments in depreciable assets other than structures for the next 5 years. While most of the provisions within the framework are intended to go into effect once the legislation is enacted, this one specifically is backdated to keep businesses from holding off on making investments while waiting for this legislation to be passed. Further, the framework seeks to limit interest expense deductions for corporations and eliminates certain other business deductions and credits. The research and development credit and low-income housing credits are specifically mentioned as two credits that would be preserved. Finally, the framework proposes measures that would encourage the repatriation of foreign profits held overseas and provides reform to discourage companies from seeking tax havens in foreign economies. While Republicans would like to push for quick action on this legislation, the complexity of reforming the tax code, combined with the number of details left to be ironed out in the plan, and a tight fall legislative calendar would make it difficult to pass this legislation before the end of 2017. However, we certainly wouldn't be surprised to see something pushed through before the end of the year quickly, especially given the prospect of using the budget reconciliation process, which would allow this bill to pass with a simple majority. We'll continue to monitor the progress of tax reform, and we'll continue working with our clients over the coming months and years to plan accordingly. With that, I'll turn it back to Jack.
Thank you, Chase. We will now open the phone lines for questions. If you have a question, please press 5, then star on your phone. You will hear an announcer saying, hand raised. When we have unmuted your line, you will hear line unmuted, and you can ask your question. Let's take a moment to assemble a roster for questions. We do have a question on the line.
Yes, this is Jim Barr. I'm asking about industry segments. You mentioned that this year the better performing segments were technologies and healthcare, and I'm wondering, looking out at the next 12 months, what you think the better performing segments will be, and if you don't mind providing a little color about why you think that.
Sure. I think it's interesting to note that last year healthcare was a lagging sector, partially due to some political uncertainty around the election, I think. And then, of course, it surged this year. So the first thing we look at is probably, well, what's lagging this year and the potential to catch up next year. So that would lead us first to energy. As I mentioned, it's the worst performing sector. And the prospect that OPEC will continue to be disciplined on production cuts. Global demand is rising. Frankly, we think that it's probably rising at a little faster rate than estimates. Suggests that, and inventories are also already coming down, suggests that oil prices could probably stay firm in the $50 to $55 a barrel range. I think if that's the case, you could see the energy sector have a much better year in 2018. I would also say that financials, which have recently had a very good performance, but if you look at the financial sector and the components of it, they're still relatively inexpensive on the bank side in particular versus historical averages. So, for example, Citigroup reported earnings this morning. It was a pretty good quarter, but the stock's still trading around tangible book value. I think with better economic growth and good and a good earnings outlook and the ability of these companies to return cash to shareholders, the financial area, in particular banks, could perform even better in 2018. So those are two areas that I would offer.
Jay, this is Jim Harto. Could you give an update on your thinking about the difference between active and passive investing?
Sure. Good morning, Jim. So where we sit today, again, in terms of our views on active and passive investing is very specific to the asset classes that we are analyzing. So as an example, we remain today of the opinion that in the large cap U.S. equity markets, as an example, that passive strategies continue to make sense based on a view that, one, as Jack pointed out, in an environment where we believe that we have firming economic activity and an anticipation of broad earnings growth and continue to have markets that are pretty reasonably and fairly priced across economic sectors where expectations remain reasonable. We just don't believe that there's a real opportunity. We don't see an opportunity for meaningful outperformance over the next 3 to 5 years from active management relative to passive management. In less efficient markets, fixed income as an example, emerging markets, we still believe that there are nuances related to those markets, some of which are structural. As we've mentioned in the past, if you take global fixed income as an index, you definitionally are allocating more money to the most indebted countries in the world in a global fixed income index. And in our minds, active management, where you have the ability to pick and choose relative to potential credits and your views around the level of interest rates, is a more appropriate avenue to gain exposure to those markets.
Okay, I don't see any more questions. I want to thank everybody for calling in and participating in our quarterly market update and outlook conference call. We will be doing this every quarter, so we look forward to future participation. As Jay mentioned, we will make available a rebroadcast of this call on our website within the next few days. Please feel free to reach out directly to Jay or myself or your advisor if you have any additional questions about what we discussed. Thanks again, and have a wonderful day.